Welcome to The Bag Drop, Untold Stories in Golf. I'm one of your co-hosts, Matt Constein. Here's our other co-host, the professor, Kevin Moore. Kevin, how are you?
I feel like I've been on like halftime this year because of all the different stuff going on. But to be clear, I am doing well. I've had my daily dose of birth control this morning. So every audience knows, I will be a no-kid family. My wife and I, that's something we decided on before we got married. And so I enjoy from my fellow friends, including my co-host here, the birth control stories of...
I'm glad I can serve a purpose in our friendship. I thought you meant like, I know the professor for listeners, he likes a concoction of vitamins and nutrients and maybe a couple chemicals here and there, but he likes to lay them out he's a very meticulous guy. I thought you were talking about some pill form, but you're talking about my life, Kevin, is your birth control. Is that what you're saying?
That's right. Anytime I need reminded about my decision-making and if it was the right or wrong, not that there is a right or wrong, but to give me confidence in my decision relative to my personality and goals of life with my lovely wife, Claire, then yeah, these stories make me empathize, but also give me confidence.
For the moms and dads listening, we had a puker this morning, all right? On the way to school, covered the back seat, projectile, the whole deal. And this is after a couple of days of just kind of normal puking, you know? It's like, oh, well, that stuff's normal, but this one has concern attached to it. So, hey, you know, there's highs and lows in a round of golf. And I think parenting is very much the same way. And I'll say this, a lot of my best rounds in golf, I didn't feel all that great. I was pretty tired, maybe a little hungover, and I shot a 62. Parenting's very similar. A lot of days I feel pretty hungover, even though I haven't touched a drop of alcohol. And those days can be pretty darn good, Professor. So I'm trying to maybe reverse some of the things you heard this morning.
Well, I know. Well, you can probably speak to this, right? The one thing kids do is reset your priorities in life in a very healthy way, where you learn to make work work becomes very unimportant in the grand scheme of things. And so it makes you able to deal with work and be productive in more meaningful ways.
Well, yeah, that's a good point. Hey, we haven't seen you in a while. And I mean that from my perspective. I miss you. I'm happy you're on this morning. We get to do an episode here where it's just you and I. We got a topic we want to chop up. Have you ever heard, Kevin, any professional golfers say the term, grow the game? Have you ever heard the term, grow the game? Are we growing the game, Professor?
I heard it so much.
Growing the game?
I heard it so much last year, I had to stop hearing it. So I had to tune out of all that pro golf talk about growing the game and everything like that. So I haven't heard it much recently. I'll tell you what, my relationship with the game might be a little healthier because of that.
We want to talk about grow the game on today's episode. And what does that really mean? What are we talking about? What are we growing? But the professor has some good points we'll discuss. But hey, before we get to your fun fact, which we always look forward to on the podcast, something just came across my text message, and I always go back through you and I and all the bullshit you and I talk about in life in the game of golf. And I totally glanced over something, but you got some new artwork on your person. And listener, I get a text message from the professor of this beefy forearm. I don't know if it was the perspective of the camera, maybe it was portrait mode, but this beefy forearm, I mean, it looked like, you know, a convict in cell block 6. Sized, like working out in the courtyard, but it was the professor's arm. And the artwork I knew instantly because I'm a golf sicko. But do you want to share with the crew your new ink?
Yeah, so this is about 6 years ago, I got my first ink done. My wife Claire's had ink already. She's like, let's get something together. So she actually designed the pie tattoo for me with a broken tee and a golf club as part of it. So I did that 6 years ago. Now, much like everyone says, you get one tattoo, then when's the next one occur? Right, that's all your mind's on. So I've sat around for a while, but I knew the design that I wanted. And then finally I got sick of waiting. And actually, I'm like, I'm doing it tomorrow. And then wake up, I'm like, I'm doing it today. And Claire, and she's a big time hop person. So he's like, actually, you got your tattoo 6 years ago today. So I'm like, all right, got to do it, right? So I took the Sweetens Cove Routing, very special place, right? Not just because of the golf course, but the friends and family I've developed through that place has been very, very meaningful in my life and some of the most meaningful people. And they've become some of the closest people in my life. So I had the routing done, just a line art, just lines representing the routing with little dots at the end, sort of a little bit of mathematical feel to it. Almost looks like a graph or a constellation for people that have seen those. Had that put down on my forum just to have it there as a forever reminder of, you know, that place being a pivotal place in my life and an influence in my life. So
it's awesome.
Look down and remind myself of that every time.
And so if you are the winner of this year's spring meeting at Sweetens Cove, you will get an exact replica of the professor's second tattoo on his body. And you can have it wherever you want. You don't have to do it on your forearm. You can put it on your back. You can put it on your
be a tramp
forehead
if you'd like it. I mean,
not a- if you like to. No, man, I thought it was really cool. And it looks good. It looks really, really neat. And like, golf and math. I mean, even the way that I know you like the simplicities of routings that just show you the angle. I thought it was really cool. Really cool ink. So ask the professor about his tat when you run into him.
I'm debating doing the Old Course one. The problem with the Old Course one, it is big.
That's going to be a back tat, buddy.
I'm like, I'll put it on the other forearm. And like, I think it would literally have to take up my entire forearm. And I'm not sure I'm there yet. Like in terms
that
of
might be,
that big
yeah.
of one.
That might be center chest, maybe all the way down. all right. We don't have a ton of time this morning, so we want to get to it. Thanks to our friends at Titleist, the SM10 wedges. We got some special guests coming up in an episode soon that we're going to be talking about. The SM10 wedges, which opens a world of scoring opportunities. You know it. Wedges are your scoring club. Crisp contact, optimal flighting, incredible spin, and those magical Bob Vokey grinds. The SM10s give you everything you need to grow your short game. Talk about growing the game. Grow your short game from the simple to the sensational. SM10s are made to make great shots happen. Professor, what's your fun fact this morning?
What do you know about pole vaulting?
I know our alma mater has a tremendous history in pole vaulting. We have, I believe, two Olympic, I think one was a gold medalist and one was a bronze medalist, but no, that's about it. Also know Ricky Fowler married a pole vaulter.
Huh. Do you know anything about how the competitions unfold?
I would assume it's best of three attempts, but I don't know.
Yeah, I thought it would be a very simplistic thing. Maybe you just like keep going until you miss or whatever sort of thing. No, but so my stepfather-in-law was a pole vaulter for Georgia Tech, set freshman records for them and so on before he stopped pole vaulting. So he didn't go all the way through his college career. But very, very high level pole vaulter. So last night I was getting educated on this. It's not at all what you think. And there is actually a ton of strategy in pole vaulting in terms of you as a competitor and what you're going to do. So one, the competition sets the starting height. So the competition, like whoever the organization is, the local school or whatever, and this is college level. I'm not sure how high school works. It's at least college level and above, I believe. They set the starting height. So they're going to choose whatever they want the starting height. From there, every pole vaulter can have three misses. All right. So you get three misses. And then, actually, I didn't clarify. On the third miss, you're out, or on the fourth miss, you're out. Three or four misses. Every pole vaulter gets that. They start at initial height. As a pole vaulter, you get to choose the heights you go at. So let's say they set 14 feet. You can be like, I'm not jumping this one. Then they go to 14.6. You can say, I'm not jumping this one. Then they go to 15. You try to jump it. Let's say you miss. You can even then sit out and say, I'm not going to jump. I'm going to wait till it goes to 15.6. And then go. So you get, as it rackets up, you get to choose when you go. So there's actually huge strategy in like, when do you make your first jump? Right? Do you try to set like a good jump in place so you at least have a score? So your goal is what? There's like a three-part goal. You want to make sure you score, right? You want to make sure you clear something.
Right.
Two, you want to make sure you clear a good jump for you, right? Near your personal record or at your personal record. And then three, depending on if you're trying to win it or not, or beat other people relative to your competition, then you have to say like, okay, do I save something for trying to get past that? You know, what I think my today's best score is, do I save some effort to try to do something past that? So for you as a pole vaulter, you decide entirely when you're jumping and when you're not. And you can sit out any round and then go at any round. All that matters is at the end of the day, you know, once you've used up your three misses or you said, I'm not going anymore, what was your best jump possible? So then it gets into the strategy of what are the other people doing? How good is the competition? How are you feeling that day? Do you, you know, you want to make sure you're not burning up energy early. what's the weather, right? Is it windy right now? But in 30 minutes, we know it's going to die down. So like, can you milk it and not use up any misses and just wait till long? So it ends up being this real kind of personal strategy game about when you go and when you're not.
Fascinating. So is the coach heavily involved in sending them out and saying, no, we're going to wait?
It depends. So he's actually part of this story where we're sharing college coach stories. Maybe that's a podcast for another day. And so it depends. Like, you know, he was making his own calls. But obviously coaches sometimes want to be involved in that for better or worse. But it's ultimately the competitor that's going to make the call. At least in his case, it was he was making the call when he went to go and when he went to sit.
I feel of like, if this is my college days, I'm just thinking about, I knew a pole vaulter at Akron, blocking on his name right now, but that would be such a nice brag. What do? I'm a pole vaulter. I mean, you don't run into many of those. And just the act of when you see them doing it, it's just such a rarity. They're like unicorns in a way. Mm-hmm. You know, when I would say I'm a golfer, yeah, my fat father-in-law plays golf. Like, what do you mean? Pole vaulter. I only see people do that every fourth year in the Olympics. That's a pretty cool flex.
Yeah. And they're all in crazy shape, right? Like, they're just all, perfect track athletes. All right. Grow the game. So that's our topic of today. As background, before we get into any nuances here, it is something very important for us to talk about, right? I think we'll make, or at least I'll make the point today how it has been, I don't know what the right word is, weaponized, commandeered, or whatever by a lot of people for their own private purposes.
Propagated.
And that's fine too. Like, I have a critique of that, but that's a natural thing, especially for businesses to do. And they need to do that because they have bottom lines to worry about. So, you know, I completely understand that. But I think it still needs to, I hope today's episode, you know, draws our attention. We still need to question that and think authentically about what we mean by grow to game and like, in what ways could that be important for golf and should we consider it? So I'll kick us off and kick it to you, especially as someone that, you know, I would look at what you've done and are continuing to try to do with New Club as a good example of grow to game. But I just want to ask you in general, like, when you hear grow to game, what does that mean to you? And I don't want you to give like your business answer of like classifying other businesses, but you personally, Matthew Constein, as a runner of a golf society and someone very invested in golf, to you, what is your, when you hear the phrase grow to game, what do you, I guess, want it to mean?
Yeah, I think from my experience and perspective, I guess grow the game is more to do with getting people into the game. So people that aren't stereotypically or typically a golfer becoming a golfer. And so I would actually say that New Club is not doing that. We are not growing the game in that traditional sense. New Club is for astute, avid, passionate golfers that are on their journey already. You know, their journey has begun, probably began at childhood. Many of our members are people like you and I who kind of fall out of sorts with the game, but they realized, you know, it was a big part of their life and they want to get back to it. That's a huge part of our membership. And then the other part is people that maybe didn't grow up with the game that really, but have already made the decision that golf is my thing. I'm going to be a golfer. I need to get out more often. I'd like to compete. I'd like to get fitted. I'd like to, you know, learn about golf course architecture. I'd like to learn about golf history. Like it's really an astute audience. So I think that in a non-traditional sense, New Club is growing the game, but I don't use or propagate that term grow the game because I think most people would associate it with junior golfers, with disadvantaged golfers or people that have not had access to the game of golf. New Club does create access in different ways, but I think New Club creates the opportunity for people to continue their journey in more meaningful, compelling, and stronger way, stronger ties. And so I'll give you this stat as kind of for me and my perspective. And how many private clubs do you think were in America in the 1930s and mid to end of the 1930s?
Mid to end of the 1930s. I'm
gonna do private golf clubs.
Private golf clubs. I don't know. I'm going maybe private golf clubs were in 30 some states. I don't know, 500.
So past, it's past the golden age, you know, it's past the industrial.
Oh, past, yeah.
Revolution. So,
shoot, but no. Because Ross built a ton, so yeah.
I would have guessed the 1200, same, honestly.
1,200 maybe, something like that?
4,000. Okay. 4,000 private clubs in the late 1930s. How many private clubs are there in America today?
See, we were at 4,000. I, 12,000?
4,000. Oh. 4,000 traditional private clubs.
Okay.
So the population of the United States has tripled. Has tripled. The number of golfers has tripled, or more than that after COVID. We're talking tripled. And the number of private clubs hasn't moved an iota. It's the exact same. And so I think, and this is the last kind of, we don't need to talk about new club this whole time, but one of the biggest things with what we're doing is all golfers want to play more golf. I've looked at the stats. Private club golfers post 82.3% more rounds per year in the USGA and in your gin or your handicap mm-hmm. service. 82.3% more rounds. If you're going to continue your journey, and so that's my level of grow the game, go deeper into the game, learn more about the game, you got to play more. You got to have more opportunity. You have to experience the cathedrals of golf or even the cathedrals of your hometown, the places that are the best places to play the game or different formats or alternate shot or get your butt to Scotland and experience the home of golf. So I think grow the game in a non-traditional sense that new club takes to heart is how do we give that, I mean, if you're looking at the math, only 8% of people belong to a traditional private club. New club can be the option for not only that 8%, because we got 35% of our members are that 8%, but the 70% of people who maybe are stuck in their golf journey. Maybe they are tired of fighting for tee times on a Saturday afternoon, or they're not getting, you know, out of the game what they're putting in. I think new club's job is to grow their experience in the game. And so that's a different way to think of it. But here's where I'll bring it. Let's get off a new club for a second. I'll kick it back to you. But I think the pool of people that get to that point in their golf life, in their golf journey, isn't big enough. But all we hear about are all these initiatives that are growing the game. The First Tee, Youth on Course, great organizations. But you know, you see these numbers. I see these numbers. And then I don't see at the end of the spectrum all the mostly guys who are talking about growing the game. I'm not seeing those kids grow up to join them. And I think that's like the continuum is broken, man. Like, I don't know what the dropout rates are and all this stuff, but you know, part of it is like, well, is it just the fact that we're going to put effort behind programs and contributions and things that are going to get kids into the game? Or does the whole structure just stink?
There might be something to be said about that. But I guess I got a couple questions. Yeah. So one of them, do you have public golf course numbers at all? Do you know what those are like from 1932 till now, what that growth looks like?
Definite would be some growth there. I think I'd have to pull them up. I only prepared my private one this morning.
Yeah.
I do have that. Yeah. I mean, I think it's well higher. I mean, it's probably 15,000, 14,000.
I'd be interested to like, what's the private membership numbers too? So 4,000 clubs.
Yeah.
How many like members, like, is that number been stagnant too? Or like, is the, you know, so as clubs have changed.
I bet you it's been pretty stagnant. I'm going to venture to say, I think it's a certain population that is always kind of reserved for those clubs, and that number's probably gone up a little bit with some efficiencies maybe, and maybe some additional courses. And, you know, some of these clubs were nine holes at one time, but
yeah,
from the 1930s till now, I bet you pretty stagnant.
Yeah, something like Athletic Club, right? Like Atlanta Athletic Club, you know, 2,000 members. We're 900 now at Athens Country Club. And like, yeah, we were 400, you know, 20 years ago. And how those numbers compared to 1932? What numbers were they at? That'd be interesting to know. So, but like,
well, what do you hear? What do you think when you hear grow the game? Because I just put my new club spin on it, but you tell me, what do you
hear? No, so I think like what the spin you put on is, yeah, there's a lot of different spectrums we can think about it on. And so I definitely think like there's grow the game as the initiative to get new people into the game. Now, I think within that, it's also very important to clarify what we mean by new. So if we think about the last, the COVID boom, let's say, right? We've had, the game has grown. I mean, you try to get tee time anywhere, the game has grown. It is in your face. The costs have gone up, right? Which again, I think we're going to do an episode sometime on ridiculous prices, but like market demand, right? And I completely believe price elasticity and moving it relative to that, as long as it's within your ethos and your principles of what you're trying to accomplish as a business. And that's an important clarification. But that's one way, so when it comes to new, have we actually seen the game grow with new people that are also, that diversify the pool of golfers, right? Like Athens Country Club, the membership now looks exactly like it did 5 years ago. We have more people, but the people look the same. Like they're the same from the same demographic, from the same business ventures, from the same regions of town, the same backgrounds and so on, right? Like they're the same people. So I think one way to think about growing a game with new people coming in, well, are we reaching populations that weren't reached before in golf, that golf wasn't accessible to them for a variety of reasons? And there's lots of different reasons we can break down, some of them quantitative and some of them qualitative. But I think that's one way to think about growing the game. And like, are we actually going after, probably not the right word, are we being inviting to anybody that has interest in it, no matter their background, no matter where they're from, where they live, who they are, what their interests are, where their political ideologies are? Is the game being grown in that way? I think that's one way to look at it. Now, I think what you said, am I capturing right what you said about New Club? Like, you want to look at, with New Club, you're looking at growing the game in a way that you're taking people that are already invested in the game and opening up new opportunities for them, new ways to think about the game, new relationships with the game, new ways to engage with the game is what you're working to accomplish with New Club. I think that's an accurate description.
I think so. I think it's like, we're not trying to persuade people into saying, you know what, I'm going to stop playing tennis or pick up basketball and I'm going to play golf. Like there's groups that do that. I think ours is, hey, if you're a golfer, if this means something to you, it means something to hundreds of us as well.
Yeah.
And join us up. And I think in the grow the game spirit, maybe one quick story, just to use an example where it's a little bit closer to that, to getting new golfers in the game, is one of our members, we'll rename nameless for this story, but we were out in California on the winter meeting and we were just talking about New Club and what it does mean to people and members. And he kind of said golf never really had a place for him. I mean, he didn't really feel welcome at the country. His dad's country club didn't really feel welcome for a variety of reasons at even some public courses and, golf in the South and some stories he shared with us were pretty heavy. But what he told us was, when I found New Club, I got the sense, and I wasn't sure, and he needed to talk to a couple other members and he needed to talk to, I think myself, and he needed to talk to somebody that knew something about it, but there was a welcoming factor. There was come as you are, as long as you love golf, right? And he was very clear about his expectation of that. And thankfully we've delivered on that and everybody accepts him for who he is and he loves the game of golf. Now, he wasn't a very good player. He had a long way to go in his journey, but he said this, and we were up in wine country, so this analogy hit hard for everybody. But he said, New Club has become his sommelier of golf. It's the way for him to taste and try and experience. Hmm. And what made it even cooler, Kevin, is another guest we have on this show recently who is so far along in his golf journey. I mean, the guy has traveled all around the world. He's played in USGA championships. He's sitting at the table and he goes, New Club is making me a sommelier in training or an assistant sommelier. And they played together that day and they're both looking at each other. And he goes, yeah, I meant to ask you, like, how the hell do you play so fast? Like, what do I need to do to play quicker? Or, hey, you hit that little chip shot. I hate chipping when the grass is right behind my ball off the fringe. How do you play that shot? And then they're talking about it. And I just lit up and so did the table where it's like, you know what? There it is. That's what it is. That's a growth of the game in one specific person, two specific people. Because that other person that has the wealth of experience, that has the wealth of knowledge in the game is now fulfilled by sharing that with someone else. And honestly, I think, and this could be changed to a negative, and I'll throw it back to you, but one of the reasons we hear so much grow the game from the world's best players, from some of the wealthiest tycoons that are leading, you know, golf industry magnates and governing bodies, is these are people that are living enchanted golf lives. And there is a level of wanting to pay it forward for sure. But when I hear it, as much as I hear it, I can only interpret it as guilt. Guilt that they have so much experience in the game. They've had, and everywhere they go, all they see are people like them doing the exact same thing. And you know what? That guilt can be a source for good, and it can produce places like the park that we just saw on the match on TV. Mm-hmm. You know, that they can have national coverage of a place that's totally affordable and accessible and a fantastic place to learn the game, and any kid can show up. I think that's why we hear so much about it, because let's face it, golf is getting more and more expensive. It's getting more and more elite. It's getting more and more exclusionary. And those guys at the top, some of them did come from nothing. Some of them did come through it, but a lot of them had a pretty good way in their golf life and their life for a long time. And I just think they recognize that, which is a good thing, but I think a lot of it's guilt, to be completely honest with you.
So do you think, I'm trying to think about like phrasing this in terms of either new club or this thing. So growth past consumption. What I hear, a way I can interpret what you're saying, especially relative to new club's purpose, is to open up that avenue where you think about, okay, growing a game, want to open up new paths to people. And that really is a path to moving past just a consumption mindset towards golf, where I just consume and I just consume. But I actually now started thinking about the game. I think about its history, its golf courses, its architecture, its place in society, its influence in society, that sort of stuff. Does that resonate with you at all, especially relative to how you think about new club and, like, you know, helping people on their second phase of their, you know, golf life?
Kevin, that resonates a lot with me, because, you know, I've been involved with First Tee and Youth on Course, and I've been involved with both Chicago. I've seen some Atlanta, not as much in Atlanta, but a lot in Chicago, a lot in Ohio. And one thought I always have is, great, there's this awesome clinic. They got 20 kids to sign up and 12 actually made it to the course. What if the PGA of America, I'll pick on them for a second, because they're heavily involved in those programs and they do junior league, which again, they need to make an effort for more courses to have junior league teams. When I look at the lineup, I see a lot of only private clubs in there, and that's a particular socioeconomic level that's going to be able to be a part of those teams. I think it's similar with other sports as well, but let's just pick on that for a second, because if instead of those 20 kids that sign up and the 12 that show up for a clinic, what if every PGA pro in America, I think there's 30,000 of them, something like that. 30,000. 30,000 pros, each of them mentored one kid. They gave them free lessons. They helped them get equipment deals where they get equipment deals. And what would that do? You know? And maybe it's not one kid. Maybe it's two. Maybe it's three. But I just know that there is this pay it forward. And they're not the right people to pick on here either. Like,
yeah,
PGA pros are some of the busiest people I know.
And they're punching bags for a lot of people.
And they're doing clinics for 20 kids and 12 kids. Yeah. And so I think about it that way. You know,
the model,
the one to one, just like that conversation that happened at that dinner table between two members, one guy sharing information with the other getting fulfillment out of it. I wonder that that's where I see the most success in these types of initiatives, is when two people are looking each other in the eye and saying, I got you. Let's do this. I'm here to help. What do you need? Scholarships? Let's talk about it. Putting practice? Sure. We'll get you the right guy. Like, I just see that as so much more effective than the shotgun approach that doesn't seem, and it's not the initial part, it's the end part. It's that spectrum. When you talk to a kid that didn't come from much, that has lived that same enchanted life of golf, usually it's one person that said, no, this is your game too. We're going to make sure you got the invites. We're going to make sure you get connected with the right people. We're going to make sure you get the practice facilities. We're going to make sure you get the right coaches. And it's not about performance in golf. Like that obviously comes to mind, but it's about sticking with it. And there's so many obstacles and costs and things that are make it really hard for people to stick with this game. And in America, that just stinks. Like we're again, back to those numbers we were talking about, like the fact more people aren't getting there is a failure of Grow the Game.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, you brought up performance too. And that, I guess that relates to like one of the reasons I propose this as a topic for us, right? The talk that I really want to talk about, because I think one of the reasons I feel passionate about in terms of just wanting to talk through it is like, I feel like Grow the Game is typically when people are saying it, some percentage, maybe 90% of the people are just literally speaking from a consumption standpoint, right? When they say Grow the Game, it's just more people into the game, spending money on the game, the end. Don't care who they are, whatever. But you brought up performance. I think there's a qualifier there, especially the junior level, like who gets most of the attention when the junior clinics are going on, the best players rise to the ranks, right? And they end up being our focus. And I think that's still it's tangential to the consumption idea, but related in the sense of like, where's the attention to the person that wants a relationship with golf beyond that, then beyond just playing and scoring, whatever, that actually wants to think about golf as something, I mean, I said almost every episode, an embodiment of life, right? That actually wants to think about golf as a vehicle for having a more fulfilled life with those that you're around, your mind, right, your body, and in the game of golf at a broader level. You don't see Grow the Game initially, like you don't see the phrase being used in those ways typically, right? Like, look at the people that are actually really honed in on people's relationship with golf, not just their consumption of it. And rarely do they use the phrase Grow the Game. And I don't know, that's unsettling to me, because that's probably where like those people that are doing that, the Jim Hartles of the world, the Stephen Proctors of the world, even, you know, people like Andy Johnson with what they're doing, and Garrett, Rob Collins, Sweetens Cove, right? Like those are the groups that should be probably using the phrase Grow the Game, or they are authentically embodying Grow the Game as a phrase, right? Because they're looking to get people at a deeper relationship with it that's beyond just going out there and you know, going through a round, maybe slugging some beers, maybe not, or whatever, and then just getting done and yucking it up and being done with it, right? Like, it's like, no, this game, we're going to have a blast out there, but we're also going to have developed stronger relationships with each other. And think about the game broader than just these 18 holes and, you know, hammer bets that we're making.
Yeah. I think you don't hear groups like that you just mentioned, or a new club as well. You don't hear us say Grow the Game because we're so burnt out on how disingenuous it's been. I mean, we're talking decades of that term being used by every USGA president and RNA captain and you know what? Like, it's just like a political term at this point. And I just think that group of people you just mentioned are too real for that. Like, they're not going to give you just a political term. They're going to, they're just going to talk about the thing, then talk about the generic thing of growing the game. You know, grow the game is you get people, I'll compliment, you know, Andy, I was with him last week. The way that he genuinely cares about people's knowledge of like what makes, you know, it's a very subjective opinion that he'll a lot of times express, but he does care about why he got to it and wants to know others' opinion, but also wants to like help people get there themselves. That's a huge way to grow the game. That's a, you know, somebody's going to lose, your back's going to go out and you're going to play shitty golf. Those guys are going to quit the game unless they have something else that keeps them interested. You know, the McKenzie quote, if we're not talking about the game, the game will, anything that creates discussion in the game is for the benefit of the game. And so that's what I feel about architecture. That's what I feel about history. Know the history of your courses, know the changes of the courses, know the agronomy team, know all that stuff. Because at the end, it's not just about getting a ball in a hole in the fewest number of shots. you need something else to keep you in that continuum on your golf journey. And so I think groups like that are doing it. But yeah, you're right. We're not talking about it because the groups that are talking about are one far larger than that subset of the little sliver of the golf world. And you're right. Consumptionism, selling more clubs, man. You know, love our friends from Titleist. I love their support for the show. But the reality is if you get another, and I do have the numbers up in front of me, Kev, or I did, what happened? I mean, 2022, we're basically tapped out. I think it was a slight decline in 2023, but you got over 40 million total golf participants. But that breaks down into about 15 million off course only and 25 million on course, which I've seen different numbers there, actually. I've actually seen it where 2022 had more off course participation than on, but oh, I know why. That's because a lot of those off course players are also playing. On-course players are also playing off-course. So those numbers, if I'm in the seat of an OEM, that's all I care about, right? I just want to see the possible addressable market. That I want to see that going up. And things like Topgolf, things like the simulator expansions, all those are going to be good for selling golf clubs.
Yeah, and that's where, like, I don't think it's a duty of OEMs to grow the game in some of the nuanced ways we're talking about. Would I like to see them do that? Absolutely, right? It's always up for a company to set certain aspects as a mission or an ethos. And sometimes that can be counter to just bottom line dollars and other times not. And so it's not on them to be trying to do these things. Of course, we hear them the most because they are the biggest. They're paying the advertising dollars and so on. But yeah, it's just this conversation is making me think of like Patrick Boyd, right? Like, all those Sweetens Cove stories of him just sitting in that shed, someone walking in and his passion for the game just being contagious, right? Even if someone's not into architecture or in Patrick's world, not only is he an architecture buff, but golf clubs. I mean, he could tell you the exact soul grind of a 1964 McGregor set of irons, right? And the lofts that are there, like off the top of his head. And that passion is contagious. And like that guy has grown the game for so many people by just them interacting with them and being like, oh my gosh, there's so much behind golf and so much to be passionate about and think about, because passion is contagious, right? Like, you want to be a good leader, be passionate about what you do, right? Obviously be an ethical actor and, you know, acting in good faith and always looking to champion and prop up other people. And then if you add passion on top of that, it's pretty hard to be a bad leader if you're active, right? Like, because passion breeds other people to want to be involved with it too and want to learn. So I think, like I said, your point too, like, touch points are important. Who's closest to you, right? Like, typically singular people influence you the most. And so I like that one-to-one model of like, yeah, bring in a young kid and be passionate about what you do and breed them into golf in a way that's bigger than just selling clubs or, you know, selling shirts and running the tee time sheet, right? Like, bring them into what golf is all about and what it does for people.
I got another avenue to explore, maybe one last point to just share around this. And it has to do with professional golf, has to do with the structure of the PGA Tour, has to do a lot with American culture and society. But philanthropy and how philanthropy works is we designed that in America, you know, big philanthropy, you'd call it. It's a tax haven. So a lot of the grow the game are, and this is a negative that could be turned to a positive. I am very thankful that a lot of rich people want to support these programs. I am very grateful that a lot of wealthy people are putting their dollars behind golf and Grow the Game initiatives and Youth on Course and First Tee and all the different programs, Evan Scholars. God, the list is long of charitable organizations in golf. But rich guys like playing golf. They like to be around golf. It has impacted their lives, to phrase it more in a positive way. It has impacted their lives in a long way, and they want to pay that forward. But philanthropy in America is a tax haven. It is a way to save dollars from Uncle Sam's pocket. And so I that's just a reality. And so when you hear these guys talking about Grow the Game, or you hear the next PGA Tour, the Live Golfer that started a foundation, they're doing some good. Thank you guys for starting your foundation. It's a tax way. It's a way to hold money from the government. And so I know that. And I just think a lot of the grow the game sentiment that we always hear, it's a little disingenuous because that is an element of it, right? That is absolutely an element of it. And why my head went to it was we had a discussion with one of our pals over in Scotland. And they don't have a lot of those programs, but they also don't have the major discrepancy in the wealth gap. And you have these really elite private clubs. Like, generally speaking, most cities in Scotland where there's thousands of clubs and, you know, per capita more golfers than anywhere except for New Zealand, which we got to get to New Zealand, by the way. I think there's a lot of cool people we'd meet down there. But they don't have the injection of charitable dollars going to those types of programs. They have some. RNA does some things more globally, right, around the world. I just watched the African Amateur, I think it was, which was awesome on television, right? It was on the Golf Channel last week. Globally, I think they expand it, but they don't feel the need to pump charitable dollars and philanthropy into those programs because they see on their range, and you and I saw it, how many kids did we see warming up at Tane the day that we walked, or the northern, I mean, we're talking remote, up there in the Highlands. How many kids? 60?
Yeah.
60 kids on the range? I didn't see a coach, by the way. I mean, it was chaos, but...
Yeah, it was.
But I have to bring that up because that is one cultural thing that, you know, America is rich get richer, go get it, capitalist culture, winner take all, star quarterback, starting pitcher, all that is rewarded. And when you get there, the expectation in our country is to charity, throw the dollars down down the steps, make sure that people can step on them to get a little bit closer to what you got. Well, in other countries, it's just different. It's just different. And I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I'm just trying to put it in the context of why do we hear so much grow the game? And yet, not much has changed at the top. Yes, a lot has changed on the bottom. Those programs have done great things thanks to a lot of those charitable dollars, thanks to the philanthropic dollars. But the continuum, it just brings me back to my same point. The continuum is broken. The journey stops for so many people. And it guts me every time. Every time I hear from a new club member that needs to drop for certain reasons, I'm like, damn, man, you love this game. I know you love this game. I know this is good for your life. But there are factors that we don't control that you are you're probably making the right decision. I'm not going to talk you out of it. You know, and that's just unfortunate. I'd love to see it change. But hey, this is the world we live in.
Yeah, I think two things can be simultaneously true. We should applaud the charity efforts that go in, that occur. And when people take time and money out of their life to give back, right? Like, we should applaud that. And that should not be construed as their actions should not be construed as negative. And yet we can look at the structures put in systemically within society, within our culture, our specific tax structures, our mindset and culture in America, and say, hey, we could do this differently. It doesn't need to be this way. Right? I mean, think of North Berwick. They got the kids course. You can't even step on as an adult and play, right? Like, that's just there for kids to consume. Talk about a way to get kids involved. Give them a place, a playground to play on. That's awesome. That they don't have to worry about some old guy being curmudgeon and yelling at them about slowing or divots when it's the old guys that are making the divots anyways, right? Not that they complain about divots overseas. So, they're not soft like that as we are over here. No, like, yeah, we could get very political and much more general just in terms of America's inability to think about social safety nets. We're such an affluent country, right? And this is extremely relevant to us right now at the University of Georgia, because we recently had a student die by suicide and then also a murder that occurred on campus all in the last week. Where
about that?
You know, the social services in terms of mental health, right? And our inability as a country to have serious conversations around that, and what we could do with the affluent nature of America, of building in nets where we wouldn't have to rely on charity to address mental health and give people the resources they need, so we don't end up with a student who's vibrant life of the party, huge support structure for his entire fraternity and friend group, could die by death by suicide, right? That he actually has the help accessible to him. You know, we have a good student care and outreach on campus, but they're overwhelmed. They don't have the financial resources to do it. We can be better. Like, we don't have to, we can applaud the efforts that are there. And then we can also step back and say, like, how can we improve? Because that's what we should always do, right? That's what every person in their life should do. And that's what every society should do, is always step back and learn from other groups and say, what can we do that we can make this better? You know, and by small incremental changes, you know, you can't change anything overnight and do drastic changes typically, but you can always make moves in that right direction. And tying it back to golf, we should think hard about that, right? What are the efforts that we can grow the game in these different ways that I think would be productive, right? More educated on the game and its relationship with life. As one version, what new club, I think, like, I appreciate your honesty of like, no, we don't bring new people into the game. We don't diversify, and we don't diversify the nature of the people that are coming to the game, but we work on educating people or just giving people a pass to learn more about the game and everything you can gain from it.
Opportunity then, is what.
Yeah. And then what other things could we do? You know, small incremental changes in terms of just making golf accessible to anybody that wants to come into it, right? That, you know, when someone comes in a game that they actually use the word welcome, right? And I always think of my wife at most of the country clubs she goes to, and she's like, man, as soon as I step on that property, it's clear I do not belong. Like, by the way people interact with you versus me, the way I'm talked about either by staff, other members, like, it is very clear I'm an outsider, you're an insider. Yeah, like, you know, we should be better, and we need to be better. And there's no reason not to be better. They would just say this is how it is, and how it's always been, or status quo. Like, gosh, be okay with being uncomfortable, right? Like, be okay saying, yeah, you know what? I love my country club, but we do things wrong, and we need to be a little bit better. It's okay to say that. That doesn't mean you love your country club any less.
Yeah.
It's just like, no, like, we can always aspire to be better and be improved. And guess what?
Ask any general manager, though, if there's people that are scared to disagree with their country club. It's just maybe not on this fact.
yeah, right. And it's like, and then
they're
too, going back
wheels for sure.
Going back to the consumption game, the more accessible and welcoming the game is, even if the efforts to make that happen do cause a financial dip at the beginning, in the long term, there will only be financial gain for companies because you have more of an audience to draw from. Like,
yeah.
Short-term, long-term profits. Like, yeah. Everybody, it's like, oh, the market says, that's a short-term mindset. Yeah. And if you look at the best companies, they never say the market says right now. Apple's one of the best examples. They always say the market says in 20 years, this is what we're doing. Yeah. Nike makes splashes. They get criticized. They have stock dips. And then you look at the five-year run and you're like, well, guess what? They keep growing.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to sum it up, to be honest. And maybe let's get a little, one of your thoughts on the shrink the game crowd. We got to shout out to folks that I'm surprised that didn't come up till now. That always makes me chuckle on the Twitter, right? Shrink the game. You can't get a tee time on Saturday morning, shrink the game. Your club that you want to join has a waiting list for another 2 years, shrink the game. So what are your thoughts for that crowd who couldn't care less about growth of the game? In fact, they wanted to go the other route. What do you have to say to them?
Honestly, I do, to be catty, I have one foot in that crowd, in the sense of, like, I have some friends that espouse that, and I agree with some underlying points. And the point I would make in terms of my agreement with it is, like, if we're growing the game and just having more wealth come in, and that's the group, and this is my personal bias, so, like, I'm not saying this is how it should be, but this is how I would like it to be. I don't care about that group coming in, right? More rich white people coming into the game and hooting and hollering and all that. And it's not the hooting and hollering that bothers me. I do that as well. I'm just saying, like, we're just bringing in the same people, and, like, that's just gross. Like, I don't care about that. Like, come on. Like, that's like you said, that's just increasing demand and all that. That's not adding any flavor to the game. I'm not learning anything new from people, right? I want new people in the game. So in that world, like, yeah, I wish we could rerun the pre-COVID in some ways, at least in the world I live in. I get there has been some diversification outside of the country club world. But within the country club world, at least my country club, like, yeah, shrink. I want 200 less members, because guess what? Now we're building wine cellars. you know, now we're doing this, we're building pickleball courts. And once that economy downturns, we're going to have a lot of infrastructure in place. And guess where those new people are going? Those new people are leaving.
Yeah.
And that's, yeah. So shrink the game, sure.
I think it's usually said tongue in cheek, and they don't truly mean it. Because if you pressed a lot of those people, you know, why do we even care? Why do we even care about growing the game? I think it's a little bit of that guilt factor I talked about earlier. You have a lot. You want others to have something special as well. The game's treated you to luxuries. It's treated you to a life experience that's rich and fulfilling that you want other people to have that as well. But I think those people, if you were to ask them, they would say, I do want to pay forward that a little bit. And on their deathbed, if you were asking them on the deathbed, they might be saying shrink the game until they're, but I bet you at the end, they're going to say, man, I wish I would have given a little bit more of myself to whatever, instead of chasing the next top 100 course, or instead of buying myself that brand new Saturday. Like, and I don't mean this, I don't want this to sound like get off your butt and go volunteer for the first tee. Although why not? I do want to think though, I'm going to bring it back to that conversation at that table and where it just really lit me up of what are the small ways you can just give back to other people? Isn't that what life is? I have gotten myself some special things in the game of golf, right? I've worked hard or connected to the right person and got myself something cool. Never has that ever fulfilled me the way that going into an event I'm running and just seeing smiles on faces, or going and teaming up with a buddy who really wanted to compete again, coming back from an ankle injury, and just being able to play with him and see how much that meant to him. And I was just his partner, right? And I just kind of made, like, think about that in that context, and then Grow the Game starts to make a little bit more sense. And it doesn't have to be this grandiose, you know, Rory or Brooks Koepka or anybody else on TV talking about Grow the Game. It can be simply, what do I have to provide as a golfer? What do I have to give to other people? Maybe it's a swing tip. Maybe it's an invite. Maybe it's taking a kid out or giving him his first set of clubs. But that's where I'd like to end, is like, grow the game in your own little small world, and you're going to feel like you achieved something. You're going to feel good. It just does. There's no, everybody that you talk to on their deathbed always talks about the stuff they did for other people. Like, that is hard to do in a busy society, but we need to do more of that. That's where I'm going to end.
No, I like that. Go back to the shrink the game thing. Like, at the end of the day, where I come down, I'm happy when anybody comes into this game and enjoys it in their own way. And I want to share the way I enjoy it, and I hope that influences them, because I think there's, you know, very rich ways to enjoy it. But at the end of the day, all that matters is people are enjoying playing the game and enjoying it in their own way, as long as that's not infringing on other people, right? And that's the most important thing. And whatever you can do in your little circle and the people you can touch to influence them and make sure that's happening, and maybe opening up new doors, and they see that door and they're like, I don't like that door. I don't care about golf course architecture. That's fine too, right? Just enjoy the game and make sure other people are enjoying it too.
Well, Professor, I enjoyed chat. You got me fired up today, man. This was a topic you've been asking to chop up on the show for quite a while. I don't know why we've pushed it off this long, but apparently I had some thoughts and so did you. So thanks for listening, everybody. I did want to ask, you know, if you enjoy this show, one of the best parts of the show for the professor and I is just getting comments and bagdrop@newclub.golf. You can send us emails if you got thoughts or questions or want to come on the show. Heck, we've already had a couple of those emails that's scheduled to come on. And please follow, subscribe, like, rate, review the show, Apple, Spotify, wherever you listen to shows. That's a big help for us, because we just want to get more people involved and enjoy this great game. Whether it grows or not, it's a great game. Professor, thanks for the chat. Thanks for Titleist for the support of this show. And throughout the season, we have a fitting coming to our members in Chicago, April 16th, with our friends at Titleist. We'll be at the Preserve at Oak Meadows. That's our first fitting opportunity for folks in the Chicagoland area. If you're listening and want to be a part of that, join us up. Atlanta, it's coming next. And then we got a little trip on the books for our friends at Titleist. So thanks for them for the support of the show. And thanks everybody for listening. We'll catch you on the next one.